The California Report returns at 8:51. Right now, Mel Baker is here with traffic, and we're heading to the South Bay.
In San Jose, northbound 87, just after the Capitol Expressway, a brush fire burning off the right-hand shoulder. Fire crews heading there. Traffic heavy to slow, northbound 101 from the Capitol Expressway up to 880, and 880 southbound from San Lorenzo to Highway 84 is heavy to slow in sections. Mel Baker for KQED.
Thanks, Mel. Come on back at 7:06. And support for KQED comes from the San Mateo County Fair, taking place June 1st through the 9th. The fair has all the favorites, like carnival rides, amazing food, and concerts available to all with general admission or general fair admission. Tickets at sanmateocountyfair.com. Some haze in the morning, clearing out, highs with sunny skies, ranging from the 50s at the coast, the upper 50s, to the low 80s inland. Good morning, I'm Sandy Althaus. You're listening to KQED-FM San Francisco, KQEI-FM North Highlands, Sacramento, 7 a.m.
Good morning. How do the presidential candidates plan to hold down the cost of health care? Our series, We the Voters, has voiced Americans' concerns. Now we hear what the candidates promise to do. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
On KQED News, sales of electric buses, big rigs, and delivery vans are growing.
Climate change hit a new record. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The new information comes out as a heat dome lingers over much of the American Southwest. Scientists directly connect one thing to the other. Also, the leader of the Washington Post tried to bury an unflattering news story about himself. And in StoryCorps, a woman traces her path toward becoming a Methodist bishop. It's Friday, June 7th. This day in 1965, a Supreme Court ruling upheld the use of contraceptives, a right that has endured up to now. The news is next.
Live from NPR News, I'm Corva Coleman. President Biden has met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in Paris. Both are attending commemorations for the 80th anniversary of D-Day. They're comparing World War II to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Biden apologized to Zelensky for the delay in U.S. aid this year to Ukraine.
I apologize for the those weeks of not knowing what's going to happen in terms of funding, because we had trouble getting the bill that we had to pass that had the money in it from some of our very conservative members who were holding it up. But we got it done finally.
Biden also announced a new aid package for $225 million. This will help Ukraine rebuild its electric grid. Russia has bombed much of Ukraine's infrastructure. It's been 8 months since the start of the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, but tensions also continue to rise on Israel's northern border with Lebanon. As NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports, a new poll finds a majority of Israelis are in favor of a war against Hezbollah, based in Lebanon.
62% of Israelis support starting a war with Hezbollah now. Just 18% say they do not. That's according to a poll released Friday by the centrist Israeli newspaper Maariv. In a speech on Thursday, Major General Ori Gordon, the head of Israel's military in the north, said, "We are prepared and ready, and when we will be ordered, the enemy will meet a strong and ready army." Overnight, Israeli fighter jets struck Hezbollah military structures, according to the Israeli military. Israel has said that Hezbollah fire has increased in the past month and a half, targeting more populated cities in the north. Israel and Hezbollah have been fighting a low-grade war since Hezbollah fired at Israel when the Gaza war began last year. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The U.S. military says it has reestablished a floating pier off Gaza that's being used to help move relief aid to Palestinians. Last month, the pier was damaged by bad weather and rough seas. Stocks opened lower this morning after the Labor Department reported stronger than expected job growth in May. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped about 14 points in early trading.
U.S. employers added 272,000 jobs in May, substantially more than forecasters had expected. Wage gains also picked up steam, averaging 4.1% over the last 12 months. The strong job and wage growth makes investors somewhat less confident the Federal Reserve will be able to cut interest rates later this year. Last month's job gains were widespread, with healthcare, hospitality, and government each adding tens of thousands of jobs. Construction companies added 22,000 jobs, even though that industry typically suffers when interest rates are high. A separate survey used to calculate the unemployment rate paints a less rosy picture of the job market. Unemployment inched up to 4% in May, even as 250,000 people left the workforce. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. California is selling a growing number of electric delivery vans, buses, and big rigs. A new state report finds that one out of six new sales is zero emission. KQED's Laura Clivens has the story.
Sales of these larger zero emissions vehicles doubled from 2022 to 2023. Governor Gavin Newsom says the state is 2 years ahead of schedule.
We're proving we can get this done. We have 60 headquartered manufacturing sub companies. It's one of our largest exports.
California is requiring state and local governments, large businesses, and ports to make a percentage of new truck purchases zero emission starting this year, ramping up to all new truck sales by 2036. Supporters of these requirements say they'll bring down the greenhouse gas emissions that contribute to a heating planet, along with harmful pollution and health disparities that come with it. I'm Laura Clivens, KQED News.
Caltrans plans to close one of the eastbound bores of the Caldecott Tunnel overnight three times next week to make repairs after a vehicle fire earlier this week. The agency says it will close bore number two, the left of the two eastbound tunnels, from 10 p.m. Monday to 4:30 a.m. Tuesday, and again the next two nights. Caltrans says crews plan to clean out soot in the tunnel caused by last Tuesday's fire. Sports, the Mariners shut out the A's 3-0. The A's start hosting the Blue Jays this evening. The Giants are in Texas for the weekend, starting up at 5 our time against the Rangers. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
And support for NPR comes from BritBox, dedicated to helping people discover a world of British TV, including new original crime thriller, After the Flood, from the producers of Happy Valley. Streaming on BritBox.com/NPR. And by the listeners of KQED. Traffic in the Altamont Pass area, here is Mel Baker.
Looking on the Central Valley side of the pass, 205 westbound is stop and go from about Nagley Road to 580. 580 on the Tracy side is slow to stop and go from 132 up to the 580-205 merge, where it stays slow to stop and go out to about North Flynn Road. There's high winds through the pass right now as well. Mel Baker for KQED.
Thanks, Mel. Come on back at 7:19. Coming up on KQED News, artist Joshua Mays, known for his futuristic murals and digital illustrations, opens a new pop-up exhibit tonight. It features a fictional city he invented called Olgaruth. You can hear more coming up at 8:22 on KQED Public Radio. Today's sunny skies, highs from the upper 50s at the coast to the low 80s inland. It should reach 83 in Livermore today, Napa 76, San Carlos 72, Sacramento today sunny with a high of 90, and 63 for San Francisco. Expect pretty much the same weather all the way through the weekend, but we'll see a bit of a rise in heat coming up early next week. It's 7:07. This is KQED Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Sandy Althaus.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. We've been reporting this week on healthcare as part of our We the Voters series. And anyone who has had sticker shock at the pharmacy or had to pay high insurance premiums every month or faced an unexpected diagnosis knows this fact. Healthcare in the U.S. is expensive. This is actually a point that President Biden and former President Trump agree on, but their ideas on how to address it could not be more different. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin is here to talk to us about all things health policy and the election. Selena, where do you want to start?
I want to zero in on something I find really fascinating that I think illustrates the different visions of these two candidates when it comes to health policy, and that is the Affordable Care Act marketplaces, otherwise known as Obamacare.
Yeah, and under Obamacare, people can buy a health plan on their own.
Yeah, exactly. So most people in the U.S. get their health coverage through their job, through Medicare if you're over 65, or through Medicaid if you're low income. But then there are people who don't get insurance through their job and make too much money to qualify for Medicaid. and that's what the marketplaces were set up for. So the federal marketplace is at healthcare.gov, and some states have their own websites. Cynthia Cox runs the program on the ACA for the health research group, KFF, and she says there's one thing about healthcare.gov that is vital to its success, making sure people know about it.
If you have had job-based coverage your whole life and suddenly you lose your job, you might not know where to go. And so that's where these like marketing and outreach efforts are really key.
Basically, she says there needs to be tabling at community events and signs on buses and TV ads and all the rest just to tell people that these marketplaces exist.
All right. So what does advertising for healthcare.gov tell us about the two presidential candidates?
Well, a lot. So we can start with former President Trump. He talked about Obamacare all the time when he was president. Here he is in June 2017 at the White House meeting with Senate Republicans about their plan to repeal and replace the whole ACA.
We have really no choice but to solve this situation. Obamacare is a total disaster. It's melting down as we speak.
So Trump's repeal and replace efforts failed back then in his first term, but he is still talking about repealing and replacing the ACA.
So with what, Selena? Because I have looked for a long time to see and find out what that replacement might be.
Yeah, he hasn't laid out a specific plan. That was a challenge for him in his first term. And like you, I still haven't seen anything that he would use specifically to replace the ACA in a second term. And the other thing I want to say is this law was passed so long ago. It was passed in 2010. And so much of the things that it did, which are wide and varied, are really baked into the healthcare system at this point. So it's really hard to imagine untangling all of that and getting rid of this law, even if there was something fantastic to replace it with.
All right, so let's go back to Trump's first term, because even though he was not able to repeal it or replace it, he was able to weaken it somewhat.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And one of the ways he did that was by slashing the budget to advertising and for navigators. So those are people whose job it is to walk people through the process of finding a plan and signing up. Katie Rodgers-Turner is with the Family Healthcare Foundation in Tampa, Florida. She has been a navigator from the beginning, and she remembers what happened when Trump took office.
When the federal administration changed, there was about an 80% decrease in funding.
Jeremy Smith is with First Choice Services based in West Virginia. He says it was the same for them. Their federal funding for navigators was slashed.
During the Trump administration, we went down to a budget of only $100,000 a year. In those years. I mean, it was only just a couple of us working on the program, and we didn't really have hardly any money for advertising or travel or the ability to get out in the community very much at all.
Under Trump, enrollment in the marketplaces also went down pretty much every year. Then when President Biden came in 2021, Smith says the change was dramatic.
Our funding increased by more than tenfold. We went from $100,000 a year to over $1 million a year. So that was just huge. I mean, it was, it just made our heads swim.
To start with, he could hire more staff and post people in remote offices in different parts of West Virginia.
So we could offer more in-person help for people that wanted to come in. We was able to add bilingual navigators at that point. We was able to actually have a pretty robust travel budget so we could get around the state and do community outreach and promotion.
In Florida, Rodgers-Turner says the story was the same.
We actually got 12 times over the budget. We went from a budget that supported 2 full-time navigators to now we have over 35 navigators in Tampa Bay, mostly of full-time individuals.
In addition to way more money for navigators, the Biden administration invested aggressively in advertising, everything from posters in supermarkets to Instagram ads to TV ads in a variety of languages, like Vietnamese. Another significant change under Biden was an increase in subsidies to make the plans people were shopping for more affordable. Most enrollees can get a plan with a premium of $10 a month or less. Here's Rodgers-Turner again.
4 years ago, premium prices, that was a big talking point for people, their inability to afford the premium prices. These past few open enrollments, people are really pleased at what they're seeing as their options.
One of those happy customers is Sydney Clifton. He's 53 and lives in Pasco County, Florida, about 30 miles west of Tampa. He had been on his wife's insurance, but then he got divorced.
I'm in the car business and I sold a lady a car that recommended Lynette that could help me.
Lynette Lacey is a navigator who works with Rodgers Turner at the Family Healthcare Foundation.
So I called Lynette and she gave me all the breakdowns on how it worked and based on the income, this, that, and the other.
Clifton says he has health issues, including diabetes, so he needed a comprehensive plan, and Lynette Lacey helped him find one.
It was like $9.75 a month, and I got the government assistance with the rebate, the $300 or something like that. So at $6.75 I could afford, because I was paying with my ex-wife, I was paying like $7.40 a month. So it's really the best decision I ever made. I love it.
He says all his providers are in network, the copays are manageable. He says he would be happy to keep the plan for as long as he can. But he doesn't love that it's Obamacare, and it won't change his plan to vote for Trump.
I'm not selfish like most people. What's the best for America is the best for America. And if that's taking this stuff away, it's taking this stuff away.
So, A, he told me if Trump gets elected and he loses his health plan, he'll figure something else out, even if that means going without insurance or getting a job with health benefits or even getting remarried.
Wow. Love for health coverage. It sounds like a saucy reality show, Selena. It just does. I'll do the reunion show, by the way. Okay. Now, you mentioned under Trump when healthcare.gov wasn't really advertised and didn't have the lower premiums, enrollment went down. What's been happening since Biden took office?
Enrollment has hit record highs nationally. There are now more than 21 million people enrolled, and enrollment has grown the most in red states, according to a recent report from KFF. For example, in Florida, where Clifton lives, and in West Virginia, enrollment has more than doubled. And the biggest growth was actually in Texas, where enrollment tripled between 2020 and 2024. Another factor I want to mention is that Medicaid grew substantially during the pandemic because of rules that allowed people to keep coverage uninterrupted. Those rules expired last year, and experts were really worried that a lot of people would lose Medicaid and become uninsured. But Cynthia Cox of KFF says what happened was this.
What we've seen is that millions of people did make that transition onto ACA Marketplace plans, which has helped keep the uninsured rate very low.
The uninsured rate in 2023 was 7.7%, according to the Federal Health Department, which is lower than it has ever been.
Wow. All right. So one clear difference between the candidates is their approach to healthcare.gov. What are some other health policy differences?
Well, Biden has managed to get some significant health policy laws through, including the Inflation Reduction Act, which allowed Medicare to negotiate the price of several very expensive prescription drugs for the first time. He also capped out-of-pocket costs for people on Medicare and fixed something called the family glitch. He's done a lot with nursing home staffing and mental health access. But one challenge for him is that some of the new laws take a while to take effect and be noticed by voters. For instance, the cap for seniors won't take effect until 2025. When it comes to Trump, Cox says there aren't a lot of details on the policies he'll push for. So it's instructive to see what he did as president.
What he tried to do was to deregulate health insurance, to try to make it cost less for the federal government.
So if Trump is elected, she expects more of that deregulatory approach to health insurance.
So there are some areas, though, of health policy where Trump is interested in regulating, and that's in two other areas that you cover, abortion and trans health.
Yeah, I think this is a really important point. So since Roe v. Wade was overturned by the Supreme Court in 2022, the Biden administration has been battling with states that have enacted abortion bans in the courts. And Biden instructed federal agencies to protect access to abortion where possible. The same is true for states passing laws about trans health policy. There are now 25 states with laws banning gender-affirming care for minors. The Biden administration has opposed those bans in courts and through agency actions. Trump has said he would take executive actions to limit access to gender transition at any age, not just for minors. And with abortion, he's spoken proudly about how he's responsible for overturning Roe v. Wade with his appointments to the Supreme Court. He would certainly reverse the current federal position that access to abortion is a right. So this is a really strong distinction between the candidates when it comes to health policy.
Are there any areas of agreement here? Anything that you might see continue regardless of who gets elected?
Yeah, there are a few. I mean, both have talked a lot about the high cost of prescription drugs. Biden has made moves to curb those prices with the copay caps and Medicare drug negotiation we talked about. Trump talked a lot about drug importation from countries like Canada with cheaper drugs when he was president. There was a law passed under Trump called the No Surprises Act to protect patients from exorbitant ER bills, and Biden has implemented that law. And price transparency is another area of some agreement. This is the idea that you, the patient, if you can see the price of services from your hospital or insurance company, you can shop around to find the best price. So it's not clear how well that's working, but it's something that has bipartisan support. But I think these areas of agreement are the exception, not the rule. These two candidates have extremely different ideas when it comes to the federal government's role in health policy.
That's NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Coming up in this week's StoryCorps, a woman talks with her wife about becoming the first openly gay bishop in the United Methodist Church. That's coming up in just a few minutes. First, though, traffic. Mel Baker returns.
In Pittsburgh, Highway 4 westbound between Railroad and Willow Pass Road is slow to stop and go in places. So no delays, though, around Concord on 680 and 242. That shows you it's Friday light. Down in Hayward, we have reports of a accident on the Washington Avenue on-ramp to southbound 880, which has blocked the entire ramp. Mel Baker for KQED.
Thank you, Mel. We'll see you again at 7:29. Support for KQED comes from Broadway SF, presenting Company, the Tony-winning best revival of a musical that reimagines one of Stephen Sondheim's most beloved works. At the Orpheum Theater now through June 29th. Tickets at BroadwaySF.com. Hassler Heating and AC, advancing California's electric initiatives by converting homes to heat pump technology. For installation or repair of heating and cooling equipment, visit HasslerHeating.com. 9 o'clock forum this morning, we discuss the opera Innocence, which has made its American premiere in San Francisco. At the heart of the story is a mass shooting at an international school and the grief and trauma that linger a decade later. That's at 9 o'clock, and then at 10.
I'm Leslie McClurg, in for Mina Kim. Next time on Forum at 10 a.m., the influence of the Tea Party on American politics. The right-wing populist movement has lost its funding arm as the conservative group Freedom Works shuts down, and as followers join the MAGA movement. We look at the history of the Tea Party and how it's shaped today's GOP. That's Forum at 10 a.m. on KQED.
Sunny skies today, with temperatures from the upper 50s at the ocean to the low 80s inland, and gusts of wind up to 20 miles per hour. This weekend should be just about the same, highs ranging from the 50s to the low 80s. Support for NPR comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 35,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. Workday, with AI at the core of its system, Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to prepare organizations for what's next. Workday, an enterprise platform for finance and HR. And the listeners of KQED. Good morning, 7:21 now.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Okay, the Washington Post has one of the more famous mottos in all of journalism: democracy dies in darkness.
Yes, but long before the paper adopted that slogan, it had become one of the nation's great newspapers, famous for its Watergate investigation and others, which is why many people in the media and, frankly, outside the media are following this news. The paper's new CEO tried to tamp down coverage of an unflattering story involving him.
One of his efforts came in a conversation with NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, who's been covering this story. David, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, so the CEO here is named Will Lewis. He's trying to restructure the Post at a difficult time for a lot of media. Circulation is down, and he's a deeply experienced guy, worked in British newspapers for many years. So what was the story about himself that he didn't want covered?
Well, Lewis faces accusations back in civil suits in London brought by Prince Harry, among others, that he was involved years ago in a cover-up. And that's a cover-up of a scandal involving illegal hacking into people's voicemails and emails by Rupert Murdoch's tabloids in their headlong pursuit of stories.
And then what happened this year when the Washington Post staff decided to report on its own CEO?
So Lewis has previously denied wrongdoing. He's done so again. It's important to note he's not a defendant in these civil suits, and he hasn't been prosecuted for any of this. At the same moment, he's at the core of a lot of these accusations. And he told Sally Busby, then the executive editor of The Washington Post, these stories simply weren't newsworthy and she shouldn't cover it. He accused Busby of a lapse in judgment in deciding to let her team go forward, although he didn't prevent it. Within about 3.5 weeks, that is at the beginning of this week on Sunday, Busby was forced out. My reporting shows that was part of a larger restructuring that would have diminished her authority over the newsroom, really split it in two. But a lot of staff is concerned that perhaps their coverage of him was part of the reason as well.
Oh, okay. Wow. Well, when you heard all of this from sources inside the Post, what did you recall from your own past reporting on this same topic, this story about Will Lewis that he didn't want published?
We addressed this back in December. We really broke a lot of the details of this as new evidence surfaced in court in London detailing the allegations and the heft for it that he was involved in a cover-up. He and I spoke, as he has now acknowledged, off the record, but that off-the-record conversation had to do with the meat of the allegations against him, not about whether or not I should drop the story. And in fact, he did push me on a number of occasions to drop the story, offering me instead an exclusive about his plans for the Post's future.
So you're saying that in a conversation that wasn't off the record, he made a quid pro quo offer to you, drop your story that I don't like, and I will give you a story, an exclusive interview that I do like. Is that it?
To misquote The Godfather, he gave me an offer I had to refuse.
Okay, and you did refuse this. You went ahead with the story then, and now you've published his effort at a quid pro quo, and Lewis has offered some on-the-record comments about all this. What does he have to say?
Right, he called me an employee rather than a journalist. Then he explicitly said I was an activist rather than a journalist working for NPR. He also said I dusted down comments that he had made 6 months ago and had made up some excuse to make a story of a non-story.
I notice he's not denying any of the facts of your story.
Well, he certainly doesn't deny pressuring me and to try to induce me to drop my story in exchange for an exclusive. He does deny having pressured his own former executive editor. But I've got to say, not only have we reported that he did that, the New York Times did, and his own reporters at the Post have done that. And what he's done is kind of launched a broadside attack on values held dear at the Post and elsewhere of the idea of a firewall, insulating the newsroom from pressure from those that it covers, including those who run its business side.
David, thanks so much.
You bet.
That's NPR's David Folkenflik.
And now it's time again for StoryCorps. Karen Olivito loved Sunday school.
As soon as I went down into that musty, smelly, crayon-y, moldy room, I was home.
She never forgot that feeling. Karen grew up to become a pastor. Then, in 2016, she became the first openly gay bishop in the history of the United Methodist Church. Over the years, she received hate mail, even death threats, but Christian ministry never ceased to be her calling. At StoryCorps, she talked with her wife, Robin Ridenour.
Was there a time in your career as a pastor that you were worried that you would lose your ordination?
Well, I've worried about that for 42 years. I remember when Michael and Sean, they said, you know, Pastor, we would really love to have a holy union, and we know it's against church rules, but would you do it? And I said, well, of course. And the little old ladies did the reception, and we are dancing together afterwards. But then I had a complaint against my ministry. I was really worried. You have seen the hate I've received. I mean, I feared for my life. We had a bodyguard for 18 months. How has that made you feel?
I have to say, I don't have the grace you have. People that you love have just turned their backs on you. To see you so hurt and so wounded, and then to watch you forgive, it's really, really hard. Because I can hold a grudge.
I appreciate that you feel that so deeply, maybe in ways that I'm afraid to touch.
Well, when you look at someone, they know that you are seeing them. I think who you are, that essence of you, is what people love.
You know, I never knew when I went to a church, would I be welcomed? I would have to prepare myself. And so I'd sit in the parking lot and I'd say, God, give me an undefended heart. We always said,
no matter what, we were going to lead with love.
Yeah.
We're going to lead with love.
Pastor Karen Olivito and her wife, Robin Ridenour, they interviewed each other for StoryCorps in Billings, Montana. Last month, the United Methodist Church dropped a ban against openly gay clergy. This interview is archived at the Library of Congress.
Major support for StoryCorps comes from Dignity Memorial, helping families protect their loved ones and gain peace of mind by planning cremations and funerals in advance. Dedicated to professionalism and compassion in every detail. More at dignitymemorial.com. And from Subaru and its retailers, partnering with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society this June to give blankets and messages of hope to patients facing cancer. Learn more at subaru.com/care.
This is NPR News.
KQED News up in just 1 minute with Brian Watt. First, though, traffic, we're off to Nevada with Mel Baker.
Where we're seeing some slowing, 101 southbound between Alameda del Prado and Lincoln Avenue in Santa Rosa on the 101 southbound to eastbound 12. Stop and go a little slow eastbound 12 to southbound 101. Mel Baker for KQED.
Thanks, Mel. Support for KQED comes from Heath Ceramics. Listeners can stop by Heath San Francisco this month to shop handmade goods from Japan and participate in workshops during the Craft from Kyoto Showcase. Details at heathceramics.com. Xfinity. Customers can get wall-to-wall Wi-Fi with Xfinity Gateway and XFi Pod that extends coverage to hard-to-reach areas. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary. You're listening to KQED-FM San Francisco. Good morning. The time now is 7:30.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. State lawmakers have introduced a new bill that would exempt the restaurant industry from California's new junk fees law. The proposal would require restaurants to clearly display mandatory fees and gratuities or risk fines. KQED's Juan Carlos Lara explains.
Last year, California passed a law aimed at banning hidden fees from all types of businesses. That law goes into effect in July. But restaurants protested when it became clear that service fees were also being banned. This latest bill, SB 1524, is intended as a clarification of last year's law and allows the fees as long as consumers are clearly notified. In a statement, San Francisco State Senator Scott Wiener, who co-authored the bill, said it, quote, strikes the right balance between supporting restaurants and delivering transparency for consumers. I'm Juan Carlos Lara, KQED News.
The Alameda City Council this week pulled the plug on an experiment by climate scientists over safety concerns, despite a report that concluded there was no risk. KQED science reporter Danielle Venton explains.
The experiment was set aboard the USS Hornet and involved spraying a combo of sea salt water components and tap water into the air. Here's project scientist Sarah Doherty from the University of Washington speaking at an Alameda City Council meeting.
So we're spraying aerosol that is extremely similar to sea salt spray on the flight deck, making specific measurements downwind on the flight deck of the Hornet. And these are not being done at a scale that can alter clouds, weather, or the climate.
The experiment was intended to collect basic information to feed into larger scale models. One day, scientists could use sea salt to intentionally brighten clouds, reflecting more heat away from Earth to counteract climate change. But the project had not sought the city's permission before starting, believing it wasn't required. So in April, Alameda asked the scientists to halt operations while they waited for the results of a city commission safety study. The study found no risk. Despite that, the city council meeting was filled with extreme concerns and hostile remarks from some members of the public and from council members. Here's council member Trish Herrera-Spencer.
I do not support moving forward ever here in Alameda on this.
The council voted unanimously to shut the project down. The study scientists expressed disappointment and urged the council to reconsider. I'm Danielle Venton, KQED News.
A San Francisco teacher is going public with concerns that the school district isn't taking the use of racial slurs on campus seriously enough. Levert Holmes teaches at John O'Connell High School. He says there have been multiple incidents since last fall where students, some black and Latino, addressed him using an anti-black racial slur. Holmes says there have been some attempts at discipline, but he doesn't think the district has a plan to address what he sees as a systemic issue.
What I hope to happen is, one, an open dialogue with administration and students, and students being held accountable.
The district declined to comment, but in a message sent to faculty in May, it said it is aware of instances of racism and takes the allegations seriously. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. As the West braces for excessive heat, the Phoenix Fire Department is rolling out a new protocol to treat heat stroke patients, putting them in a bag filled with ice. That story's coming up in the next segment of Morning Edition. Support for NPR comes from Bank of America, offering access to resources and digital tools designed to help local to global companies make moves for their businesses. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And by the listeners of KQED. Good morning, Sandy Althaus here, and the time is 7:34.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Millions of Americans are trapped, for now, in a heat dome.
And that has prompted excessive heat warnings and heat advisories that extend from California and Arizona into Nevada and then eastward into Texas.
That's a meteorologist with CBS in the Bay Area. The heat dome is a big pocket of high pressure that locks in heat. It's pushed temperatures in the Southwest 20 to 30 degrees higher than normal for this time of year. And now we have news on a cause of that heat. New data shows that the planet-warming pollution that drives extreme weather has hit a new record.
Rebecca Hersher from NPR's Climate Desk is covering this. Rebecca, good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, what is the connection between climate change generally and this specific heat event?
They're intimately connected, Steve. You know, humans burn oil and gas and coal. It releases carbon dioxide and other planet-warming gases. Those gases, they accumulate in the atmosphere over the course of decades. And all that excess gas traps heat, and that directly leads to higher temperatures worldwide. It helps drive these extreme heat events where the temperature gets really high and stays really high, like what we're seeing. And in fact, scientists can say that the most intense heat waves that are happening right now would be literally impossible without human-caused climate change. So it's a really close connection.
Okay, but our news here is that carbon dioxide levels are hitting a record. Many people who follow this are aware that the United States has been cutting its greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah, that did happen, but the decrease was quite small. This was last year, and 2 years before that, the U.S. emissions actually increased each year. So the bigger picture here is that, you know, one, the U.S. decrease in emissions is not that big, and two, a lot of other countries are not cutting their emissions. So altogether, it's definitely not enough on its own to reverse this trend of CO2 accumulation in the atmosphere.
Yeah, there is the question of the rest of the world, which is the majority of the world's people and the majority of the economic activity. So how is the carbon dioxide level measured?
Well, scientists continuously measure CO2 in the atmosphere, and every single year, the peak CO2 amount sets a new record because humans keep adding more CO2 faster than it can break down. This has been happening since scientists started measurements in 1958. And because scientists are able to use other methods as well to estimate how much CO2 was in the atmosphere going back millennia, we can actually say with confidence that there's more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere now than there has been in millions of years.
In millions of years. Okay, so how high is this number?
Well, the exact number is 426.9 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. That may not sound like a lot, parts per million, but the Earth is really, really sensitive to changes in the atmosphere. A little bit of extra CO2 traps a lot of heat. What really sticks out is that this number is significantly higher than last year. It was a really, really big jump. So the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere is actually accelerating.
Rebecca, thanks for the update. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
That's NPR's Rebecca Hersher.
Election Day is still months away, but the battle over voting rolls has already begun. Many states allow mail ballots that are postmarked on or before Election Day to be counted, even if they arrive after Election Day. But in some states, Republicans are asking courts to stop that. NPR's Ashley Lopez has this report.
During the pandemic, Nevada created a universal mail-in ballot program alongside the state's regular in-person elections. Carrie Dermick is with the group All Voting is Local.
And so now what we're seeing is if you're an active Nevada registered voter, you automatically receive a vote-by-mail ballot. So it's completely changed how our elections work.
For ballots returned through the mail, as long as it's postmarked by Election Day and gets to officials by 5 p.m. on the fourth day after Election Day, the ballot is counted. Dermick says lawmakers created this wiggle room for voters in case they forget or there are issues with the post office. But the Trump campaign and the Republican National Committee say this return window is illegal.
Basically, rather than Election Day, it creates an election period in violation of federal statute.
That's Christina Bob with the RNC. Her group filed a lawsuit against Nevada election officials, arguing an election period is set federally and it ends on Election Day. Bob says states accepting late arriving ballots is an election security issue.
The way to make the election the most secure is that everybody has the same finish line.
Bob is a former Trump attorney who was indicted earlier this year in Arizona in connection to the campaign's efforts to overturn the 2020 election. She pleaded not guilty. Roughly 20 states plus Washington, D.C. accept and count postmarked ballots they receive after Election Day. And there's no evidence that those states are more likely to have fraudulent elections because of their return window. Kevin Munoz with the Biden campaign says these are common sense rules with a long history.
States have permitted the counting of ballots received after Election Day for over a century. In Pennsylvania and New Jersey, that practice, for example, it dates back to 1813 and 1815. So, no, this is not new.
But these kinds of lawsuits are. Munoz says the Republican challenges are meant to sow distrust in American elections. But Christina Bob says the reason the RNC is newly focused on late arriving ballots is because laws around absentee voting have changed a lot in the last few years, including in Nevada.
When it comes to mail-in ballots and dates received and dates processed and all of that, I would say COVID was a game changer.
The RNC has also filed a similar challenge in Mississippi. Sam Paisley with the Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee says this is part of a larger GOP effort. She says her group has tracked at least 47 bills across 18 states over the past 2 years that would shorten the time allowed for mail-in ballots to be counted.
They obviously have made the calculation that it's for their political benefit.
And the potential political benefits are significant. During the 2020 election, President Biden beat Donald Trump in Nevada by about 33,000 votes. In Clark County alone, which is where Las Vegas is, state officials say about 40,000 mail ballots came in after Election Day during the 2022 election. Carrie Dermick says in Nevada, invalidating ballots that arrive after Election Day could impact all kinds of voters.
If we have somebody that's working like multiple jobs and has multiple children, and you know, this is just not something that is 100% like top of their mind, and they forget about their vote by mail ballot, and they are able to put it in a mail on Election Day, that really does increase their access.
Challenges to late arriving ballots, including in Nevada, are currently moving through the courts. For now, it's unclear how close to the election any of these cases will be resolved. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
Okay, as we head into the weekend, here's a news story I did not see coming. Love is heating up on the ice.
Join Scott Simon to learn about the popularity of hockey romance novels. That is tomorrow on Weekend Edition.
Hockey romance. Hope you don't lose a tooth. Or something else on the ice.
Yeah, that doesn't sound
warmer.
Sexy. That doesn't sound
Go
sexy.
Go somewhere warmer You're for right. the hot stuff. But it starts apparently on the ice. Or
yeah.
However it is, Scott Simon is a romantic guy. I'm sure this is a fascinating interview.
Me too.
We'll listen to NPR's Weekend Edition.
This is NPR News. Coming up a little later on the Marketplace Morning Report, we've been looking at some of the ways cities are changing to meet the future of how we work and live. And today we hear from the director of the School of Cities at the University of Toronto about how major North American cities are recovering from pandemic-related economic shocks. That's on Marketplace Morning Report at just about 7:50. Right now, we're checking back with Mel Baker in the latest traffic.
In San Francisco, 101 northbound between Silver Avenue and the Hospital Curve, it's stop and go. On the Bay Bridge, rather light, remarkably, it's just backed up to the parking lot before the metering lights. Slow, though, across from Treasure Island to Fremont Street in San Francisco. On the San Mateo Bridge, a little slowing westbound from the Toll Plaza out to the county line. No slowing on the Dunbarton. Mel Baker for KQED.
And traffic support comes from Murphy Mechanic Construction. Support for KQED comes from Visit Modesto, offering a summer filled with nostalgia and fruit. Visitors can explore farm stands, pick fruit, and experience graffiti summer starting June 5th. More at visitmodesto.com. UCSF Health. Excellent healthcare should have no boundaries. That's why UCSF Health is spreading its love to more patients in more neighborhoods across the city. To learn more, visit ucsfhealth.org/with love.
Hi, I'm Madi Bolaños, co-host of the California Report. In just a bit, you'll hear what's going on across the state on the only daily statewide show. Stick around for the latest news and updates with help from reporters across the Golden State. You can also subscribe to our California Report podcast. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. That's the California Report coming up on the air and online.
That's coming up at 8:51, and then today at 11.
On the next Science Friday, how stories can be weapons on a propaganda battlefield.
It's not the opening stage in a debate. It is a weapon. They're delivering weaponized messages that can't be met with rational responses.
Bringing military psychological warfare techniques to modern politics on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Palestinian-American artist Samia Halabi's first American retrospective was cancelled amid her criticism of Israel over the war in Gaza. We visit her art studio next time, Here and Now.
Here and Now today at noon. Support for NPR comes from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital markets solutions. Disclosures at raymondjames.com. Easy Cater, committed to helping companies sell food, from employee meal plans to on-site staffing, with corporate accounts, nationwide restaurant coverage, and payment by invoice. EasyCater.com. And by the listeners of KQED. Good morning. It's 7:45.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The European Union is holding its parliamentary election this week. The results will help shape the direction of the EU for the next 5 years. But there's something different this time. 16-year-olds are eligible to vote in Germany and Belgium. Those two countries join a growing list that have lowered the voting age from 18. To learn more, our colleague A. Martinez spoke with Pavel Zerka with the European Council on Foreign Relations.
So first off, tell us about the decision to lower the voting age below 18. Why now?
So it makes sense because when you are 16, you already have some obligations. So for example, if you work, you need to pay taxes. You already have the right to take some medical decisions or to enter a marriage or a civil partnership. Then why shouldn't be that accompanied with the right to vote? The second reason which I can see is that European population is getting older. So there is a risk that if mostly old people vote in elections, then also they choose parties that defend the priorities representative for the older population, whereas the younger voters do not get their representation at the political level. And I think that this poses a certain democratic problem, because actually it's the younger voters who will live longer with the consequences of the political choices that are taken today. And I think that some people with a more pro-European outlook might have thought that if there is danger of Europe moving increasingly towards far-right and anti-European positions, then younger voters who tend to be more pro-European should be an easy way to boost the share of votes on the pro-European parties.
Okay. How excited are the teenagers, 16 and 17-year-olds, to be able to participate in this way? Have you heard any reaction to this lowering of the voting age?
We know that the young voters are much less likely to participate in elections than the older ones. Although 5 years ago in European elections, younger voters have beaten their record of participation, so many people hope that also this time they could actually prove to be more eager to vote than is usually assumed.
Now, what difference do you think that lowering the voting age might have on the elections? Will there be something that we'll notice?
Symbolically, it's a very important event because it shows that younger people and their voice is treated seriously. And I believe that after Germany and those couple of other countries where already the voting age is lower, perhaps some other countries in Europe would also follow the suit.
Could it be about tapping into the energy of someone who's 16 or 17 years old? I mean, I can imagine that someone that has wanted to vote, they're going to be very energetic possibly to get out there and be involved and participate in discussion.
Maybe Europe, which is getting older, is looking for that new energy that the younger voters can represent. But yeah, I think that in a way, the lowering of the vote could also be an encouragement for those people who are over 18 but still young. They could understand this move as a way to show that young people are important, and therefore maybe they themselves would also be more eager to go out and vote in the election.
That is Pavel Zurka. He's Senior Policy Fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you very much.
Many thanks.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by B.J. Lederman. I'm E. Martinez.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
The Marketplace Morning Report is coming up next. First, though, traffic. Mel Baker is back looking at a problem in Cotati.
101 northbound just before Railroad Avenue. CHP running a traffic brake to clear a bunch of boxes from one of the left lanes. Traffic is slow all the way down to Petaluma Boulevard. 101 in the southbound direction from Alameda del Prado down to Lincoln Avenue is slow, and it's stop and go on 37 westbound from Wilson to the lane merge, a little slow out to the raceway. Mel Baker for KQED.
President Biden won Nevada in 2020, but it was a nail-biter. This year, younger voters are pretty upset with him about cost of living, among other things.
It's like, angering because it affects everyone. Like, yeah. I'm 23 years old, and I don't think I could afford to move out on my own anytime soon into my own apartment, let alone my own house. Yeah.
Could Trump take back this crucial state? That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered at 1 this afternoon. You can also hear it later in the afternoon at 5. Civil rights leaders Art Johnston and Pepe Peña are a force behind LGBTQ plus equality through their iconic gay bar in Chicago. Catch the story of the long struggle for equality and their fight to love freely in a new Pride Month special of Art and Pep, Monday night at 9 on KQED 9. Today on our local news podcast, The Bay, California is in the middle of figuring out how it wants to regulate artificial intelligence. We'll hear how those efforts are going and how AI could affect us all. That's on The Bay, wherever you get your podcasts. Well, let's just move to the sunny skies part for today, with high temperatures ranging from the upper 50s at the coast to the low 80s inland. 83 later in Livermore, 63 expected in San Francisco.
A blockbuster, but also mixed, jobs report.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab, helping people invest in ideas they believe in with Schwab Investing Themes, with more than 40 themes to choose from. More at schwab.com.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishor, in for David Brancaccio. We learned earlier this morning the U.S. economy added 272,000 jobs in May. That is a lot stronger than expected, and it is 110,000 more jobs than the month before.
But at the same time, the unemployment rate ticked up to 4%. To help dig through all this, we are joined by Julia Coronado. She's founder and president of Macro Policy Perspectives and a professor at the University of Texas, Austin. Hi, Julia.
Good morning.
So it seems like a good news, not great news situation. Why don't we start with the positive? What do you see there?
Well, on the positive side, we got many more jobs than expected, and it was very broad-based. So we saw most sectors are still hiring. The only sector showing job losses was temporary help, but state and local governments, healthcare, manufacturing, construction, just broad-based job gains.
So then what's the downside?
The downside is we have two surveys here. One is saying everything is great, and the other one is saying that unemployment is creeping higher and that actually labor force participation is falling back a bit. So they're just mixed messages from these reports.
Why, by the way, are predictions so off so often these days?
You know, the data collection in a post-pandemic world is really, really difficult. Response rates to surveys are down. Seasonal patterns of economic activity have shifted. So really, we really need to gather as much data as we can to get the full picture.
Julia Coronado, president of Macro Policy Perspectives, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And with that, let's do the numbers. The Dow is up 151 points. That is 0.4%. The S&P 500 is up 0.2%. The NASDAQ is up less than 0.1%. And the yield on the 10-year Treasury popped up a bit. It's at 4.430%. One of the fun things about the jobs report is you can see what kinds of jobs are increasing the most or, less fun, shrinking the most. For example, in this recent jobs report, the occupation that grew the most in percentage terms in the 3 months through May was water transportation, up 4%. But in one of the hottest sectors, artificial intelligence, there's hardly a data point to guide us. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that.
The jobs report lists tech jobs under a bunch of headings: computing infrastructure, data processing, computer systems design. Notice artificial intelligence isn't one of them.
It is not going to tell us that.
Betsy Stevenson is former chief economist at the Labor Department. She says to find out if AI is impacting other non-tech workers, she'll be watching to see who's gaining or losing ground. For example,
do we see unemployment rates of recent college graduates going up?
Because they're often in jobs requiring computational and analytic skills that AI can do better and faster. Andy Challenger at outplacement firm Challenger Gray & Christmas says he expects increased job displacement in
administrative types of positions, technical writing, going out, pulling together large sets of data.
He says companies faced pushback last year when they started citing AI as a reason for layoffs. Lately, they've been blaming technological updates instead. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Amazon Business. From small business to big enterprise and everything in between, Amazon Business helps simplify the supplies buying process. Amazon Business, your partner for smart business buying.
This week, we've been looking at some of the ways cities are changing to meet the future of how we work and live. A lot of those changes have come as a result of the pandemic and the prevalence of remote work. In some cases, cities are struggling with a so-called real estate doom loop. That's when fewer people work downtown, so therefore fewer people hang out downtown, and then more things close. But it's not all doom and gloom. Karen Chappell is director of the School of Cities at the University of Toronto, which has been tracking how cities are recovering economically. She spoke with my Marketplace colleague, Nova Sappho.
In our series, we've explored a number of cities, but especially striking are the problems in St. Louis. It's in the middle of a doom loop, right? How do cities find themselves in such a situation, and how do they get themselves out of it?
I'm generally cautious with the use of the term doom loop because I think it applies to very few cities. Very few cities are so dependent on their commercial tax revenues that they're actually going to have to reduce the level and quality of their services. Yet, St. Louis and a few other cities are really struggling. So I think we need to look to the success stories and learn from those. I think, you know, the Clevelands of the world that have kind of come roaring back a lot of it due to kind of strategic office to residential conversions, targeted investments, trying to make sure that there's a core or a node of residential, commercial, and entertainment and retail uses where people want to go, and then kind of building up from there.
We're catching you when you're visiting Chicago for another data project, but I'm curious about what you're seeing there because of the office vacancies and the problems in commercial real estate.
So when we look at Chicago, and one of the things we've done recently is compare after work hours activity to work hour activity, and Chicago really stands out because its activity is nearly back to normal, yet its work hour activity, Monday to Friday, 8 to 6, is around 60%. So it's really struggling to get that workforce back.
And so what does the successful growing city of the future look like?
I think we need to crack the retail nut. So, you know, maybe we didn't need so many big chain drugstores and Targets in downtown, especially the drugstores we're seeing, they are folding right and left. So, you know, what are we going to do with those types of spaces? And how can we just get activity in those storefronts? I think it's going to be really important for cities.
Karen Chappell, Director of the School of Cities at the University of Toronto, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Professor Chappell there was speaking with Marketplace's Nova Sappho. Our executive producer is Kelly Silvera. Our digital producer is Dylan Miettinen. Our engineers are Jessen Dueler and John Brewington. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report.